Welcome back. So excited to have you here. Today we are talking with Wesley David. He is a musician, he's an XJW, and I specifically invited him on this channel because I am so fascinated with how he was able to turn it around. One day he popped up on my TikTok feed, and I really appreciated how he turned his pain into his purpose. Before we begin, I want to thank you so much for liking, sharing, and subscribing to my channel. It just goes to show there's hope and positivity on the other side of high control religion. If you're new here, my name is Wendy. I was in the Jehovah's Witness organization for over 3 decades, and I just decided to start a YouTube channel to have a place for people to tell their stories. Again, the only difference between you and me is that I have a camera, but that's honestly it. The survivor stories on this channel, the fact that you have volunteered your time to come on in an effort to help other people. It's true that in our stories, we find each other, and in each other, we find ourselves. So thank you for coming on this channel and for telling your story. And I want to remind you that there are people in the comments continually waking up and finding themselves in the stories that we tell.
Thank you for having me, Wendy. It's a pleasure. My background. Yeah, I'm a musician. I was born and raised a witness in the East Coast. And I left the organization when I was 21. So 17, 18 years ago, however old I am now. I almost don't know where to begin. It's weird. I feel like, you know, the I'm sure you can relate to the sense that you've had like two lives, right? And part of the healing journey for me, and the strange thing to try to communicate to other people is that you want to like heal the two lives, because it's all you. It's all like you live both of them, right? And it's your life. It's your one big crazy life. Finding context, finding perspective, maybe doing therapy. But you know, that's probably mentally, in a weird way, it's been like my number one kind of goal. It's ongoing. You know, I went through a period where I was very hostile to, still hostile in a sense to the Watchtower Society. But, you know, I went through a period where I felt very hostile towards, I don't know, just witnesses in general, even my parents and whatever. And as I've gotten older, that's kind of receded, I think, to a better place where you try to see the whole thing in perspective. And you also try to see some of the benefits of what you went through, because I don't know. Now I'm rambling, but like anything in life which is difficult or traumatic, it's still, I think, an opportunity to try to take the good from it and see how it helped you grow and helped you become a bigger person.
You're not rambling. What you're saying,
the podcast is not a ramble.
Nothing is all good or all bad. Like, you're not
exactly. Yeah,
you can have really positive takeaways from really shitty situations.
Yeah, exactly.
When you were in the organization, what was your JW career like?
I got baptized pretty late, actually. I think I was 17 when I got baptized. I never pioneered. In my middle to late teens, I started going out in service like a lot more. Call it heavy part time, but make 20 or 30 hours a month or something. But I don't think I felt that pressure. We had an unusual, we had a little bit of an unusual family situation. I had a sister, my only sister, who had a somewhat serious health concern for a lot of her life until she was a teenager. I wouldn't say we were strict witnesses, but we were also not fringe by any sense. We were sort of in the middle, like made pretty much all the meetings. None of us were pioneers. My dad wasn't an elder or anything like that. I think as you approach, you know, in high schools, I homeschooled instead of homeschooling first and then finishing public school, I went to public school and then I homeschooled my last 2 years of high school, which is a bizarre decision still in retrospect. but yeah, I mean, I don't think I got any education those last couple of years of self-education. Yeah. I don't know. I think the pressure as you become a teenager and then maybe approach 20, the pressure is there in a few ways. Like, well, are you going to go to Bethel if you're a guy? Are you going to get married? Most of my friends got married at like 19 or 20. Are you going to get on a path towards either pioneering or towards more service in the congregation? Are you going to give finance? There's all kinds of pressures. You know, there's a pressure of waking up every day and expecting the end to come anytime soon. So after 9/11, that's the, for context, that's around when, how old was I when 9/11 happened? 9/11, I remember being very seismic, and you know, it's not that anybody specifically said the end is coming like tomorrow from the hall, but I remember it being like just a ratcheting up of like, oh, okay, this is real. Like this is happening. It was you know, confirmation bias of all the typical tropes that JWs teach. So it was only about maybe 2 years after that I was on my way out of the organization.
I remember that. I was 21 and I was pioneering at the time. And I remember that was all anybody talked about was, this is it. This is the time of the end. It was like cataclysmic. And you really did almost feel it. I love that you said that it's confirmation bias, because that is exactly what it was.
Yeah.
So what was your wake up point? Was it just, obviously it's a series of events. It's never one moment, but what was it that started pushing you out a bit?
Well, I had these musical dreams, and I was actually a pretty obnoxious teenager in many ways. had you known me? No, I was a really curious kid. I'm pretty intellectual. And I also, further context, at the end of the 90s, this is still like the early days of the internet, the wild west days of AOL, of the internet. And I found a forum where there were witnesses participating. And I also stumbled onto a couple of books, thanks to the forum. And one was written by, one was Ray France. And the other was a book from another author who was a witness and became like a Bible scholar. He wrote a book which had a lot to say about JW teachings and blood and date setting. And that, and the Franz book, and I was, anyone who's done this, I can't even describe to you how like frightening, like on one hand, like it's like eye opening, and you're driven to keep reading and keep, I was chatting with a couple people on this forum, but also like praying daily and like going through like sweats and terror and thinking that Jehovah was going to, you know, obliterate me and all that stuff. And, but I was very afraid, but I pushed on. Like the information from Franz's book just leaps off the page. What he's talking about, you know, the governing body and the corruption and flip flopping on a lot of things. So there was like no turning back for me once I found some of that stuff, and just led me on the path out of the organization.
And it's once you know it, you can't unknow it at all.
Exactly.
So you mentioned you are a musician, and so obviously you can't be, with the exception of some outliers in the celebrity world, in the Hollywood world, you can't do that and be an active JW at the same time. Some do, but what was that experience like for you?
Prince.
To be Prince. Everybody says that.
Right.
What was that experience like for you, being a musician, being an artist, and kind of feeling like your dreams get to a point where you can't pursue them?
I felt very hopeless. I remember a conversation, I want to say with my dad, maybe around age 16 or so, where I was definitely very actively feeling like, no, like I'm going to be the one, like I'm going to be the one who is in a rock band, like, and has all this success and is still going to meetings and going out in service. Around that time, I definitely became obvious that there was no way that was going to happen. There was a real hopelessness to it. I want to say between when I started homeschooling and also going out in field service a lot more. If any non-JWs are watching your channel, that's missionary work. It's what Joe Woods is called, like local missionary work, basically. I replaced it with thinking that I would do it in the paradise, you know, millions of years from now or whatever. Oh. But it's a paradoxical feeling to say like, well, I have this thing that I want so much, but I'm sacrificing it for, you know, what I believe is the greater good. Listen, witnesses did it. My dad, who will probably eventually watch this one day, he's like, he also basically left my immediate family left the organization. Also, you know, he'll tell you that, you know, he remembers when people were selling their homes, burning records in the 70s. So there's a lot of nuttiness.
Nuttiness. That's putting it so sweetly, really.
Yeah. You feel like you're doing the right thing. I think when you're young too, especially, you also feel like your heartache about it, because you don't want to be doing the right thing. You want to be pursuing what's authentic for you.
And know? Now having had that experience, and now you are an accomplished musician and you are touring and you are performing, are you parlaying that experience into your art now? And kind of talk us through how you, when you woke up and you found peace and, oh, I can be a musician and God is not going to destroy me and I am acceptable. What was that moment like for you when you finally said, this is what I want and I feel okay doing it?
It was really exciting, but it was also terrifying. It was when I was 21, I got my own apartment for a few months. I took an ill-advised trip to the UK. I got super sick, very, very sick.
No.
And then I came back and I started going to a community college. It was kind of piecemeal. I mean, there was, I definitely had like good days and bad days. I had days where I'm sure you can, any former JWs can relate to this. There really is a hangover which lasts for quite a while of like dysfunction mentally. So there were like hangover days. And then there were days where it's like, oh my God, I'm 21 and I can go to college now. I can go play in a band. I can do all this. It kind of wavered. I'm very grateful. I'm super grateful. I'm even right now making like a mid career pre-midlife crisis pivot music a little bit. But yeah, no, I'm super grateful. I got a chance to play professionally and do a lot of fun stuff in music that I would not have gotten to do had I stayed in the organization.
And I absolutely love that you explained it like it's a hangover. That
it is.
It's such a great way to explain it. It's this fog that you
It's a fog.
And,
yeah.
Yeah, and it'll hit you some days and you feel like you're doing great and then you feel a little lost just randomly. Tell us a little bit about your music career and what it looks like. And you popped up on my TikTok and you started singing songs about being a JW. I don't remember if it was a parody or something, but what does life look like for you now after you've gone through all of this and you kind of fought to get here? And let me just say, if you're watching this and you do feel that you are at a certain age and it's too late for you, that's what the organization wants us to think, right? Like it's too late for us. And so that's why a lot of people go back, is because they grieve the missed opportunities. So where you're at right now, it's beautiful. So tell us what got you there.
Thank you so much. Yeah. I went to school for music. And I, even as a witness, music was my escape for sure. Like playing in bands. I was doing drums, then guitar, piano. And I've written hundreds and hundreds of songs. I started writing a lot, actually going to meetings, like Thursday night meetings. I would be writing, there'd be Our Kingdom Ministry on one half of my portfolio, and the other half would be like a lyric sheet, age like 13 or 14, I'd be working on. So I wrote a lot in my teens. I wrote a lot in my 20s. I played a lot in and out of bands ever since since leaving the organization. But after college, I fell into the performance known as dueling pianos, where it's like two piano players taking requests. And it's a whole show, like a kind of an act. Yeah, I've done that pretty much ever since, like professionally. I've gotten to play a lot of fun shows, a lot of kids birthday parties, a lot of baby Shark and Baby Got Back. I tell people, one's for the kids, one's for the drunk moms, the wine moms. No, I've had a lot of fun. I've gotten to play a lot in the Southwest. Lived in LA for a number of years, and I recently moved back to the Northeast. And a couple of years ago during the pandemic, like super committed to my own songs all over again, and social media, the necessary evil when you're a content creator, as you well know, putting stuff out. And it's been really fun. It's kind of a personal, I wouldn't say hobby, because I'm quite serious about it, but the internet is a little bit of a game changer, that you can do things sort of your way. You can take your time if you want to with it. You can kind of find your audience on whatever that audience may be. You can kind of like find that audience on social media who will be into what you're doing.
And earlier, before we started recording, you mentioned something about social media, and I mentioned the trolls. So I want to get into that. And you had I don't know what your message was yet, but I'm interested to see what you have to say about that and what your experience has been
of social media and trolling.
Yeah.
How long do we have?
I'm new at this whole trolling thing. I am of the mindset that if you're going to leave me nasty comments that you otherwise wouldn't say in person, then I must be doing something right. I don't really feel that way. I'm trying to adopt that mentality because I am. Yeah. But it's rough. out here.
It's terrible. I mean, I'm sure. And are those, I'm going to make you the host and you the podcast. Is it about JW? Is it current witnesses you think doing that? Or
it can be, it can't. The thing is, when a lot of people are able to hide behind an alias, they think that they can take liberties. They think that they can impugn motives. They can, the latest, and I don't mind talking about this. The latest was this whole Twitter conversation. It was so bad, I deleted my app, that somebody just said that for victims to come on the channel, that they should be compensated. And on my channel, with the exception of a few people, people volunteer through my website. They come on and they want to tell their story. And it made me feel terrible. Like I speak to hundreds of people who have been through that organization. And I think that the part that's terrifying is that how did we come from collectively going through something so traumatic to now I'm capitalizing and monopolizing on people's trauma? Like that's just not at all who I am. And it really hurt me bad to the fact that I shut down October and November, and I'm not scheduling anything until December to recalibrate and to not give anything like that any energy. I wish I could tell you.
Good for you.
That I don't care. I wish I could tell you that, but because of so many people who have come on my channel, I don't take that lightly. I don't at all.
Right.
So that was my experience. So.
Yeah, no, it's terrible. I mean, the good part is that everybody can have a voice, and the bad part is that everybody can have a voice. I mean, and that any idiot can have their, you know, their thing amplified if it gets enough likes, right? Enough likes and hearts and comments. That's how all these platforms work. We see that with hate speech, but we see it just with less than you know, extremely bad taste, but which is just people being mean and just nasty. Yeah. And just for anybody watching, like, until you get to a certain Twitter just introduced a thing for where you can tip people. But most of these platforms, like for example, Instagram, to my knowledge, there's not like a monetizing element. Like if you have a certain threshold, if you have a million followers, you'll start getting like branding opportunities. But it's not like Instagram's like, here you go, like nice job. Here's nice post. Right. Here's like $500.
No, I wish
they don't do that. Yeah. So there's no money being doled out.
Well, YouTube works where at 1,000 subscribers, Google will pay you. I don't mind Google paying me. I don't have a Patreon. Yeah. I volunteer to do this. The only difference between you and me is that I have a camera. Like So YouTube will pay, you start monetizing, but they have a threshold for $100. And if your videos, the click-through rate makes $100, then you can get paid. But that could be 6 months, 8 months before you see anything. There's this misconception that if you're a content creator, you must be rolling in the dough. Like,
oh no. Yeah.
It's not the case at all. I work a full-time day job and I'm a mom. And, you know, it, for some people, it's fun to just create. And you understand that as an artist too. So I'm hoping it dies down, but most importantly, I'm hoping we aren't as impacted, because being in that organization, people's perception was always our fault. No matter what people thought, we were convinced that we were in control of that. And that's just not the case. We're just not.
Uh-huh. Yeah. All that monetization stuff also takes time to get your platform to like those heights. But yeah, I mean, it's a long haul. Yeah. You're doing it because you want to help, and people share their stories because it's nice to get something off your chest and share your story. Yeah. I think social media, it's not like I didn't do it until the pandemic, but I really like sort of deep dived into a couple of platforms. I became like a lurker on Reddit and Twitter, just more like observing how people interact. And there's a lot that turns me off. I know it's taboo to weigh into politics, but so we don't have to, but I say, even as a mostly left-leaning person, that it's a lot happening which seems specific to the internet and social media, which is just really bad. I mean, like cancellation, and people like openly hating each other, death threats, like somebody doxing somebody. If somebody watching this, please Google this if you don't believe me.
Right.
There's a lot of really terrible behavior, which is like a kind of revenge when you don't like what somebody has to say. Now, it is true that Twitter, probably especially, is very provocative, and people really feel like they're anonymous. Doesn't have to be about politics, but whatever, they can say whatever they want. And again, it's the consensus model. So if you say something, in fact, you're actually the really messed up thing is that you're almost incentivized to say something which will get attention, which tends to be the craziest thing. You know what I mean? Like the thing which tends to be more inflammatory tends to get more attention, which tends to get more likes and comments, or even if people don't like it, but they still engage with it. So my hope in talking maybe to people who've left from the organization is that, you know, you go through a period where you're looking for the who are you and the maybe your identity or what you believe after being a witness. I went through that, and at first it's like this for me, at least. It tends to come back a little more into like a zone where you feel good about it. Social media avoids the gray area of life, which is the real thing, like, you know, like the zone where there's often two sides to a story, often. And but social media doesn't, especially Twitter, doesn't want you to think that. I want you to think that the answer is either this or it's that. It's like either like the farthest explanation on this side or on that side. And there's not a lot of room for being somewhere in the middle, having a sane conversation, even when we disagree with each other about important things. There's a lot to work to do there if we want to have a better quality internet. That's how I feel about it.
And especially coming from black and white thinking, us versus them, and I'm right and they're wrong.
Yeah.
This is what I say often is that, you know, you can leave the cult, but that doesn't mean the cult leaves you. So I do find this often too, is that you just replace one set of beliefs or one way of thinking for another. And it's terrible that is what social media has become. What started out as, you know, the early days of Facebook, and I remember was like, oh, look at this, you know, grandma and grandpa and people that I knew from high school has turned into this. I love that you said that it's almost, it's reinforced behavior. For example, if a child is having a tantrum, they're doing it to get attention.
Yeah.
And then that's reinforcing that behavior.
Yes.
And sometimes I don't know how to respond. And believe me, I'm not sitting here saying I don't get a lot of negative comments for the most part. My comments have been positive, but I see it on other XJW creators. I just see people just kind of going at each other simply because there's a difference in beliefs and opinions.
Yeah. It's become, you know, you can avoid it. But if you spend a lot of time on social media, I think, and especially if you're making content, then it's tougher to avoid because it's just like, just in your face kind of no matter what. Yeah. And it's also, you know, it doesn't have to be politics, but there's a lot of things on social media where it's a little bit of like join a group. Right. And then like prove yourself to that group. You see it with left versus right politics. I don't mean to piss anybody off watching this. I hope no one takes it that way, but, you see it with like, I saw a group of vegans attack a young woman who was formerly vegan, but the story goes that she related that she had to start eating small amounts of fish as instructed by a doctor. They attacked her for that. So there's something in the design of the social media where it's like, you're either in the group or you're out of the group. And if you're out of the group, we're going to troll you and hate you and leave nasty comments. We need to invert that. I think it's not that you can't have the thing that you identify with the most. You sure can. That's all good. But we also need to like have like a sane space in the middle where we can get along with each other and not do that.
And it comes from people wanting to be heard.
Yeah.
I think this whole silencing someone else, to me, it's a sense of entitlement. Like your opinion does not matter more than mine does, when really everybody's opinion matters. It's just lack of respect. This was even in the organization. First of all, you couldn't ever disagree in the organization. So we're so used to just being in compliance and being in the group that when we take that out of the organization, we have two extremes I've noticed. Either we have people pleasers who don't have their own voice or don't hold on to their own thoughts and feelings and opinions, or we have the ones who are simply trying to stir the shit, which is exactly what I see happening. And it's kind of sad to know that this is happening. And I don't speak for all victims. I certainly don't speak for all XJWs. I don't speak for anybody but myself. But I agree with you. I think there has to come a point where we're like, listen, I don't agree with you, but I really want to know why you feel the way you feel. I'm very like childlike, approaching life with a childlike curiosity is something we don't see that often.
No, I agree. It's important also. I would add, you know, the journey from being a witness is not exactly what you're saying, but the journey from being a witness, which is apolitical, let's be honest, we don't vote. Right. I think I made the comment the other on something that I think a lot of at least witnesses in America would probably vote. If they were currently in the organization, they could vote. They'd probably vote Republican, but not all. So you leave something that's like kind of apolitical, and then are like awashed in just how polarized our country has become in some of this stuff. And yeah, it's a real minefield.
Religion and politics, two very polarizing conversations. But really, it should be like, there's narcissism in all of us, and I talk a lot about narcissism, but empathy is like, make me understand, not I want to dominate you. I want you to believe what I believe.
And that's how democracy works ideally. Mm-hmm. I mean to be able to have a, you know, agree to disagree, just like peaceful conversation with somebody if you're liberal who's conservative, or mm-hmm. vice versa. Mm-hmm. To me, that's a good goal, because I don't think anybody, and no one who I love on Instagram, my mostly pretty far left friends want to hear this, but like, I don't think anybody like owns the truth or owns the right to speak. Mm-hmm. I think that's actually pretty important. I mean, you don't own the right to speak. Other people have a right to have their voice too, even when you don't like what they have to say. It's a missing feature from the internet. We used to have it in like the town square. We don't really have that anymore because we live online. So I think,
wouldn't you agree that there's fear in talking about how you feel, even off social media? You know, you're forming new communities outside the organization, right? Usually in that organization, the conversation was predictable. Everybody, you knew what you were going to talk about already. You could probably script it, right? But now we're forming new communities, and not only do I really not know what you're talking about yet, but it's, if I have an opinion, because I left the religion 2019, 2020.
Before the pandemic.
I started waking up, I should say. And I left at a time when the world was in such civil and political and social unrest.
Terrible.
And I'm just I don't have a filter. So I would talk to my non-JW friends and be like, so can you believe it? Like, what's this about? And I mean, I think this is the case. And like, Wendy, you just need to keep your mouth shut. Like, I kind of walked into things pretty blindly. And now these years later, there is a certain amount of fear. And I see that in the XJW community too. Like, you can't say this because they're going to react a certain way. And I wonder how we're going to get to that point of not being afraid to say what we want to say or think how we want to think without the fear of losing people. That is culty thinking.
It is culty thinking. It's also like people pleasing a little bit. And maybe it comes from a good intention. Like you want to be a friendly person. You want to accommodate people. That's a good place in your heart. But I mean, the downside of that is like, well, I have to make everybody happy all the time. That's almost impossible. I feel like I've also wrestled with this a little bit. I've sort of come to that you have to say what's true for you in a way that you hope is helpful. You're just trying to like decide how do I make people happy and how do I make everybody happy? But everybody believes something else. So there's no way to do that. There's no way to make everybody happy. This isn't
and life, trying to be agreeable. It's not so much people pleasing for me. It's there's a very good chance I'm wrong.
Yeah.
And I'm okay with that.
Right. So, right.
Yeah. I don't double down on my opinions, especially publicly, because I just feel like this is why I have a question mark is always like, I want a necklace that has a question mark, because I actually don't know. And I'm okay not knowing. So I would say, hey, you know what? Tell me where you came to that conclusion. I would rather know than believe. That's the divide. In the religion, I believed and thought I knew.
Yeah.
And now I realized I did not know anything.
Yeah, I can relate to that for sure. I feel like I've been completing a little personal journey with that. It's also okay to realize at the end of the day, your framework or your belief or whatever can be at the end of the day what you believe and what works for you and what makes the most sense to you. Obviously, you know, if you're a skeptical person, you left something like the organization, you want it to be true. You don't want to believe in unicorns. But it's also, I'll believe you. Sure. Everybody's different. What everybody, you know, people who have faith or people who don't have faith, that people kind of find what works for them. There's an unsolvable paradox here. I think knowing what's true and being like open-minded is extremely important to being like a healthy adult. At the same time, it's also okay. I had a moment where I was at one of my favorite cafes here in Pennsylvania, in New Hope. And I was writing, I was like, you know, it's okay to have something that's mine, like my kind of unique framework. It's okay for it to change one day. It's okay for it to keep changing, and probably will. It's okay for it to not be this like perfect, like absolute monolith. And I've got to go like convert other people and prove it to other people. And I've got to go, you know, it's okay for it to not be that. I can let that go. It's okay for it to like really work for me and like enable me to feel good as my belief, my framework. It's complicated, you know?
It's complicated. I love that you said that. Last night I had a conversation with someone and it's true. You said you don't have to go around proving it to other people.
Yeah.
That is all we knew, thinking we had the truth. So we have to convince other people that this is the truth. And now sometimes I wonder if we carry that with us in an effort to, this is my truth, therefore it should be yours also.
Yeah. Yeah. And you have to defend it. You've got to like, you've got to prop it up. And yeah, instead I think it's fine for it to be like, this is mine. This is what I've come to. This is what works for me. And when that defense mechanism pops up, it's like, but what if it's wrong? Well, it's okay. Like,
it's okay.
It's okay if it's, you know, it's okay if you keep upgrading it as time goes on. So like growing that sense of kind of like, it's very challenging, but like that peace with what you don't know. For me, the first so many years after the organization, there is no peace. You're just like, what do I think? What do I think? What do I believe? Who am I? What do I think? Who am I? Okay. That cycle
right.
goes on and on.
Even about myself, it's like, I don't know what to think of myself. What do you think of me? You know, it's very much like that. And again, these are the conversations we're having repeatedly, not just about politics or anything like that, or what's going on in our country, but things like what happens when we die. It's what I've noticed is when people leave the organization, they're grieving the loss of loved ones all over again, because you thought you had this hope that's not true. And then you have to kind of have to reconcile that we don't know what happens when we die. And for someone who wants answers, that can be a really huge mountain to climb. But I found peace in not knowing. I spent so long thinking, and I was the worst PME ever, Wes. Good JW, you're wrong. I was. And so now that for me to say, you know what, I don't know. I got so much peace in that.
That's awesome.
And now we're at the point where there's someone in our audience who was where you were when you were that young musician, someone who just really wants to bust out. What would you say to the younger version of you who is still, and let's face it, we're honestly, you've just spoke at length about how we're still figuring things out. Yeah. What would you say to that person who has this dream, who has this fire within them, and they're still kind of terrified? What would you say to the younger version of you?
Don't waste time in resentment.
Mm.
Yeah. You don't have to stay stuck there. I don't know if I wasted time, but I probably could have spent more time productively. Not, maybe there's no way to not have your feelings and grief and anger and all the confusion, but my knee jerk reaction was to think that, you know, it was all just a waste of time. Every meeting, it was a waste of time. Every experience was a waste of time. And to be very, very spiteful about that. I wish I could have made a few of the mental changes in my 30s now that I could have had in my earlier to mid 20s of just like, move on. Like, you can move on. Like, save these thoughts and feelings for therapy. And then, dude, there's so much life to be lived. Like, there's so much to explore, you know?
Yes, I love it. One of my favorite quotes about resentment is that resentment is you drinking the poison and expecting the other person to feel the pain.
Yeah.
And that stuck with me. And granted, all the emotions have their place. Anger overturns laws. You know, we were taught that anger is a bad feeling. Like, it's wrong to feel that.
Yeah. I mean, I was, I still feel, angsty towards the organization, the leadership, especially the sense of like the sort of rank and file witnesses. I think there are a lot of good people who are sucked into easy answers. Right. You could say there are probably a lot of similar organizations. I define it quite differently than like going to church once a year or twice a year, the holidays, and having I'm Catholic or I'm Jewish or I'm kind of my background. And that's like a different kind of religiosity than being a Scientologist, which is like, it's like all in all the time. Yeah. You're wearing the goggles, and it's like the end is coming. It's a totally different religious like ballgame. And when I was going, there were more meetings. I mean, they did away with the books. They actually trimmed it down, funny enough. And they changed some of the way that field service operates. I don't feel angry towards like witnesses in general. I think they're caught in a belief system, and they're not questioning it the way if they were from the outside, they'd probably see the same kind of things. I do feel differently though about the leadership of the Watchtower Society. And I think that they probably know what they're doing by and large. I'm sure most of them like really believe it too. But I find it hard to believe that they're not aware that they're using, you know, psychological manipulation and leverage, the concept of psychological leverage to get people to do what you want them to do. Pardon my French, it's a lot of fucked up shit. And cults.
I wonder that. How could you not be that far up, know what's going on financially, know what's going on legally? How can you be that far up and still
financially?
Still how?
Oh, yeah.
And as it's the hallmark of a cult is hitting all the pain points of the members. So one of the identifying marks, that's a JW term. One of the identifying marks of a cult is you, as humans, we are looking for answers, life's perplexing questions. And so, and honestly, you throw someone's life in front of them, people will do anything for their own salvation. That otherwise rational people can do very irrational things when it comes to saving their own skin. And so that's what religion monopolizes on. That's the whole point. And I agree with you. It's not a matter of just going to a church on Sunday. They are also victims. I agree with you on that. On the inside, leadership, totally different animal, totally different.
It's tough to explain to people who haven't been through it. You know?
Yes. Sometimes I don't bother. Yeah, I used to enter a room and say, "Hi, I'm Wendy. I left a cult." But now it's like,
right.
that's not my identity anymore. The way that being was my identity. Yeah.
And so you've been out for almost 4 years now, it seems like. Or...
Yes. So I started waking up 2018 when I was doing theater. I was performing, and a lot of my friends are LGBTQ. And I did a show called the 25th Annual Putnam County Spelling Bee. It's a comedy, it's a funny show. But I played this 12-year-old girl who had two dads. And she talked, and all of her songs, she talks all about not having a mom. It's just, it's a comedy. But anyway,
Modern Family.
Exactly. Yeah. And I posted on social media that I was in this play and I was still going to meetings. I was still activish. And I got this message from somebody who, it was very damning, this message. And that was one of my moments. And my best friend was a musical director and his husband they are my family. And I remember feeling this conflict of why do I love them so much, but it feels wrong. I went to him one day and I said, "Listen, I think I'm waking up from this religion." And he said, "Well, now you know what it's like to come out of the closet." He said, "But also," he said, "I knew you would never fully love me. And I wanted you to know what unconditional love is like." He changed my life. And then wow. I just started digging. And then I heard about the ARC and here we are. I want to know all now that you've talked about your healing journey and what life in the organization was like for you, how have things kind of calmed down for you, but starting up in a good way? What's life now for you?
I still play, I still do the piano shows. That's, it's kind of like my day job. And I'm pretty focused like almost full time on my music and, like, one day, like a platform, social media and, maybe a podcast. I'm not sure yet, but, I'd like to, if I can be helpful to people who are leaving groups or who have left groups. It's a very multifarious journey. It's not like just one thing. It's so many things. I have a background. I've done a lot of therapy. I have a little bit of background in philosophy, from college, actually. There's a lot of things to think your way through. But also times when thinking becomes the problem, I think, after JW's where, your emotional journey and maybe things like meditation also are very helpful to like be able to like stop the crazy every so often. So I'm kind of working through that. I'm thinking I'd like to be of help if I can be. And then I'm all in on, I'm a songwriter. I've been writing songs since I was a kid, very inspired by bands like Oasis. You can tell from my haircut. I'm playing in the UK next year. I've been playing a lot of shows around the Northeast, for my own music, and that's been fun. And somebody can look up Wesley David on Spotify or all the normal platforms if they want to. I'm at a point where I'm having fun with what I'm doing. I am branching out. I'm also trying to be in a place, as horribly cliche as this will sound, but where you focus less on a JW mindset of like the end or like the end product, the end goal. You do focus more on what am I doing today? What's my process today? What am I feeling engaged with today? And go from there. It doesn't mean don't have goals, because there's a million things I want to do. So I do have goals. But I think it means focus less on the result, focus more on what are you doing and what are you joyful about? And what can you get good at? And then having a little bit of what I'm bad at, what I'm trying to unlearn is I'm weirdly bad at having like a little bit of like a, I don't want to say the word faith, but like a little bit of like a trust in the unknown good stuff that might happen. I don't know why I'm wired like that, but just having like a little bit of trust that, you know, if you're a halfway competent human being, you will get better at something. Like you will, if you put your mind to it and you are committed to it, you will get better at it. You will just, you got to trust yourself to do the work and that the result, whatever the ceiling is for the thing that you're doing, but the result will take care of itself if you focus on what you are enjoying. And if you're really enjoying it, somebody else will enjoy it too. Like somebody, it's been the social media part of the journey is I've asked myself a couple times, like, I don't know. I'm just like this weird guy who likes this certain brand of music. And I was a Jehovah's Witness and I think we should be nicer to each other. I think we should be nicer to each other on Twitter. And here's why. And here are my ideas. And I don't know, is there an audience for that? I think there is, but even that's like a little bit where I'm like, I'm just going to say it and trust that if it's 10 people in a shack somewhere, then that'll be my audience. But
in the age of influencers where, you know, millions of people determine your self-worth, that is not right. There actually is right. An audience of what you're trying to do. And, you know, maybe if I may be so bold to say, is there is fear and uncertainty, because that there's vulnerability in that accepting that we don't know. And there is also a relinquishing of control. Right. So when we are attached to an outcome, or when we're attached to a future that we
unplug a book here for
Brené Brown is one of my favorite authors.
This
of
is a great
time.
Book.
That is a great book.
It's all about vulnerability and like and that letting go.
Bravery.
Yeah. Right. Right. Right.
Yeah. So fear of that's one of the things that I've learned through my counseling journey and reading amazing books like that is that sometimes we don't want to be part of something we don't have control over. That's all we knew is controlled lifestyles. So I am so excited you came on this channel and for you to want to help others. I already know by the end of this show, by the end of this episode, people are already going to feel helped and inspired.
And I have a, a new EP out called Satori. Get the into the light. No, it's a little tough there. All right. Got to find the good lighting. Satori, it's on cassette on my Bandcamp, wesleydavid.bandcamp.com. And also for free on all the platforms, but I'm signing these. I've only got 20 or so left. And I'm signing them and sending them out. And that's what I've been working on. It was recorded with Tom Flowers, who is a producer for Steve Perry from Journey. He's Steve Perry's guy. Don't stop believing. So you can listen to some rock and roll if you're interested from a former witness, my Bandcamp.
That is so awesome. Congrats, man. Thank you so much for being on here.
Yeah, love to be back for sure.
For your music and for the way you just make people laugh sometimes with your TikToks. It's most importantly for walking that path ahead of someone else. That's what's really inspiring.
Thank you for doing such an awesome channel and for giving people a voice. That's what this that's what people were looking for.
Thank you for saying that. And I hope that that's how it's continually conveyed, that that's what we're trying to do here. Okay. But
so part of my crazy like year and a half leading out of the organization, the one part was like the books I found and the internet, as I described and what I was learning. And then the other part was I tried and sort of succeeded to convince a couple of my close friends and also my sister of what I had learned about the society. And I was going still to meetings for like the better part of a year where I guess I was PME, right? Physically in PMO for like a year. And I felt like I was having an out-of-body experience at times because I was learning so much. And even like I had a book about, you know, what the translation is from the neural translation to the word organization, which the society inserts. And that not only the literal word in English, but the sense of that word, like an organization in modern English, you almost think like a corporate type setting, which is a major problem with the organization. Right. That sense does not translate. That doesn't correctly translate from the Greek to any applicable translation of the Bible. So I was going to meetings and making the rounds and like keeping up appearances so that on the one hand I could still like talk to friends I cared about and try to set up this way that, you know, how was I going to like introduce them to what I was learning about the society. And on the other hand, it was like my eyes had opened, and even that, like hearing people's comments and then reading the publications like with new eyes about reading the neural translation with new eyes since they've since updated it with some of those translational issues. And it was just freaky. It was freaky even singing the songs. And, you know, we can maybe have a sidebar about like, you know, some of the Kingdom melodies are like, I don't know, like they're kind of nice. They're nice like songs, whatever. But like the words in many of the songs are like propaganda. But they read like propaganda, but you don't really think about that when you're like an active witness. But so for that year, like I had to psych myself up to go to meetings and know that I was gonna like encounter this world. It's the weirdest thing. It's the tough part to communicate. It was like, it's still your world. Like, you know, it like the back of your hand. So it's yours. It's familiar. But it's not, the glue is gone now because you don't trust it. And you see it as this insidious, creation, which it kind of is in some ways, you know?
Well, yeah, it's like a former relationship.
I'm going back to my ex for, you know,
right. Yeah. Yeah. It's just like, it's another version of yourself, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Also I had to make peace with that too. Like, I don't dislike any of the versions of myself anymore because I got here thanks to her. I was not on my best behavior in that organization, and I did shun and I did judge others. And now I'm grateful having gone through that because I know how terrible it actually was. What we didn't mention though is, you disassociated, right? You wrote a letter. What was the details behind that? If you don't mind mentioning, what made you do that?
I wrote a letter. Yeah, I did write a letter. It was a couple of years after my last meeting. So I would have been 23 or so. You know, the most harrowing experience, maybe a couple of people find this interesting. I met a girl who towards a very, I had a handful of meetings left. I met a girl who was studying with elders from my congregation. When I found this out, so she wasn't a witness, but she was studying. I met her totally randomly. This young girl who was about my age. And when I found that out, I went into like action mode and I told her all about what I was learning. I think I even shared Ray Franz's book with her. She freaked out. And funny, we had a conversation where it seemed like she was like, okay, this is good to know. And then I feel like maybe she had another Bible study or she had something where whoever was studying with her intuited that she had strange questions or questions that they couldn't answer. And so they got the book and it made it back to the elders at my congregation. They announced from the podium. I don't think I've ever shared this story with anybody except my family. They announced from the podium that there was going to be a special elders meeting immediately after. And it was a Thursday night meeting. And as soon as the meeting ended, two of them came over to me and asked me to come back with them. So I said, I may have some excuse, like I have a family emergency, and I booked it out of there. But I'm sure that they were about to, it was too coincidental. They were about to grill me, and probably show me that they took this book from this girl who I met. I must have met her at maybe a Barnes and Noble or something. It was totally random. Mm-hmm. It was a very bizarre kind of experience on the way out. You know, it was, you talk about confirmation bias, but it was like right place, right time, where it might've been like the final nail for me. It was like, okay, I'm out of here. Like this is the true colors of the kind of insanity that really does operate at the leadership level, where this is not a religion based on, like, you know, your faith in Christ or something, like in a more kind of like wholesome, arguably wholesome way. This is like a control thing. Like they would have asked me probably that night. I'm sure I was about to have my judicial meeting like that night or the next day or something.
You're smart. I'm out of here. And I appreciate the fact that you didn't dignify it by showing up and going to the meeting just so that they have no authority over you. I appreciate that you mentioned the music as well. One of the moments for me, I know they had to change a lot of the lyrics because they stole a lot of classical music. But one of the things I found fascinating is I realized the impact that music has on indoctrination. And mm-hmm. once they did away with the old songbook, I didn't feel connected as I normally did growing up. They changed the songbook. The impact that, and you know this more than I do, the impact that music has on our emotions and our connection to something is massive.
Oh yeah.
And I wonder if that also started waking up, because I love music. Like it's in my soul.
Yeah. Same. Yeah.
And it disconnected me looking back when they changed the songbook around.
Huh. That's very interesting. You know, they changed it, and the new translation of the New World Translation, both definitely happened after I was gone.
Yeah. The
new World Translation. Right.
All right. So we'll catch up with you another time, Wes. Thanks.
Okay. Sounds good. Thanks, Wendy.
Thank you so much for watching this episode. And if you want to reach out to Wesley, all of his information, his tour dates, everything you need to know about him is in the description box. Be sure to follow him on social media, follow him on TikTok. His music is beautiful, and it's such an inspiration to see countless people come through this channel and turn their pain into their purpose. So we want to thank you so much for being part of this channel. And if you want to tell your story, go to wendyrenee.com and the schedule will pop right up. And that's all we have for today. Thank you so much for watching.